Welcome to another episode of Talking Filthy Police Podcast. Your host, Dan Spencer. Today's guest, Victor Dobro. Victor is a lieutenant in the Washington, D.C. area for a local police agency. He's an actor, been on several HBO series, AMC, The Walking Dead, Hellcat Razor. He's going to break down his side hustle and also being a good leader and commander in today's policing. So enjoy this show sponsored by Filthy Pirate Coffee. Fill up that coffee mug, sit back, listen, and enjoy. Welcome to the show, Victor Dobro. How are you, sir?
Good. How are you?
Good. So you are a retired police officer and an actor extraordinaire?
A current police officer, but thank you.
Oh, you still are current. Okay.
Yeah, I have four more years. Even people I work with will email me and say, hey, did you retire? And I would kind of get frustrated and say, no, did you? Because, no, I still have 4 years left.
Wow. So that's crazy. So you're juggling, I mean, obviously law enforcement is a full-time commitment,
yeah.
Right? And
yeah.
Then now you're also doing a lot of, based on your bio, you've been in a lot of different shows, TV shows, HBO shows, those types of things. And how does that work for you, man? Are you tired? Are you burned out?
Very. And I tell people it's, the hardest thing is having two young children, toddlers, you know, we call them Irish twins, but age, 3 and 2. And so like something has to give because my appetite for knowledge and growth and hobbies is bigger than what I can handle. So, you know, am I going to work out today or am I going to study or am I going to do I need sleep or so? What I found is that, you know, the last 13 months I've been really focusing on acting and I've been working a lot of less police overtime. My annual income has actually went down for acting like lower paying jobs at first, but I think it's worth it for mental health and wellness. but I explain to people too, it's just really like day player roles. So, I mean, for example, I was in Georgetown, DC, Washington, DC yesterday filming a movie. And it was my day off and it wasn't a lot of money and I worked all day long. But still that was probably like half of what I would have made had I just came in for patrol related overtime. But, I do it when and where I can, and I haven't had to have any major conflicts yet where people are asking me for weeks of filming. But that'll mean you're a series regular, you're more in demand, you're a leading role, and I'm not there yet. I'm basically what they call like a day player. So, you know, I come in for 1 day, 2 days, 3 days. And a lot of times it's scheduled out in advance. So overall, it's just difficult juggling life in general, you know, being a cop and everything. But with the acting, it's the same thing. But people are like, oh, you have to be retired or how are you doing this? Well, I'm just scheduling and trying to schedule my sleep and schedule my exercise.
Yeah, I get it. When I started the coffee thing, you know, I was full time and I was involved in some pretty time-consuming assignments, and it was hard. It was hard to find time to do the coffee, but more importantly, it was hard to find time to be a dad and a husband and all that other stuff. In which I found, at some point, you're right. Something's got to give, and you got to figure out what's most important to you and how you balance that, because your side hustle can burn you out real quick with working full time as well. So let's back up just a second.
Sure.
How did you get involved in acting? How did that come about?
So I was going to Comic Cons, and I was getting autographs, signatures. I was collecting comic books, getting the celebrities to sign the comic books that were kind of like where they played in a movie or show that the comic book's based off of. So it was very small niche of the industry, but I thought it was pretty cool. And then I started going to like the horror conventions, and you know, I was always a horror fan, but I was getting all these autographs, and I became a real big like Friday the 13th fan, and I've always been a fan. But when you're like a super fan of something very specific, people will know you because you travel in the same groups basically, and they make these like fan films, low budget or $50,000 budget. And so I had a friend at the time that reached out to me and asked me if I would help him, assist him with a fan film. And I was like, yeah, sure. And I had a few lines and they ended up not using it, but I basically was a cameo. So my first appearance ever on screen acting is just really like a walking cameo background. But yeah, from there, my wife just showed me like a social media post saying The Walking Dead in Richmond, Virginia for Walking Dead World Beyond. We're looking for current or former police officers or soldiers. And I said, well, cool. So I didn't have like an acting resume. All I had was like one little thing under my belt. But what I did is I sent them like some good pictures of me on duty, Class A, graduation photos. You know, I was on a rifle party, color guard, honor guard for my agency. So, you know, you're looking as sharp as you can. And surprise, I just got a call back, and they wanted me as a featured recurring. So I just parlayed everything, you know, parlay. You get one thing under your belt and you go to the next. And, you know, an established actor's not going to list background acting on a resume. You only list, you know, like good speaking roles. But when you're brand new to the industry, you list whatever you've done. And so that's what I did. So like these background roles led to, you know, other roles, speaking roles, and then one on top of the other. So right now I'm really at the pinnacle of where I've been. I'm on a roll. Obviously I'm on an HBO show called We Own the City. And so people are seeing that I'm getting new agents, you know, new talent agents. And they want to represent somebody that's working hard, that's active, that's showing that they can be marketable. They're not going to just, and it's a misconception where you can just wake up one day and say, yeah, I want to be a model or an actor, and I need to find an agent. That's not how it works. Like, agent's one of the last things you need. But I'm getting a lot of success now as I go. With the limited training I have, I tell people I'm really self-taught on YouTube. You know, we talk about hobbies. I self-taught how to do that drag race in a quarter mile with a Dodge Hellcat, because I'm not going to drag race out on the streets and get killed. So I was like, you know, let's do it the legal way. And you just have to have some support and friends and surround yourself with people that are like-minded. And the funny story is I met John Bernthal at a Walking Dead convention near his old hometown, or where his wife's side of family lives, I guess, in Pittsburgh area. And it was his birthday, and I was the last fan to go up to his line, and I was late driving hours to get there. And he was trying to leave. His handlers were escorting him away, and he saw me, and I had that look of disappointment, like a little kid, like, oh, I can't get your autograph, sir. And I was going to let him go, but he looked at me and he goes, no, bring him over. And I was like, oh, thank you so much. So he signs a couple comic books and took a selfie with me. And I was like, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And then I would have never thought like 6 years later, I'm acting in a TV show with him. So I saw him.
And, yeah, that's super cool.
And I told him the story, and I took another selfie and I showed him to him. And I was like, hey, can we reenact this selfie? And yeah, that was really cool. So now he's a coworker. I can't say he's a friend, but he has asked me about police work. He's very interested. He wants to know all sides of the issue of, you know, the problems with policing in America. And he's one of the very few actors that is open-minded, in my opinion, to really listen to a police officer's point of view, because most people don't, they just want to shut it down. And he may not agree with everything I say or think, but at least he's listening. He's asking about my family, wife and kids. What do I think about policing in America, recruiting? Where are we headed? Most actors aren't going to even have that discussion with me or be honest about it. You know,
that's interesting. So you didn't go to acting school, or you have, or you just completely self-taught and learned on the job?
I am now. So I'm kind of doing everything out of order. And like I said, everyone in the industry will say first thing you need is headshots. You know, go pay $350, $500 to get a professional headshot. That was one of the last things I did. But yeah, so you can do a lot of research on YouTube, any hobby, anything you want to get into, you can become the best at it. And I mean, my secret is just my drive. And most successful actors are going to have this drive where you continue to work and audition, whether or not you're booking auditions or not, and you're on to the next one, and you're always trying to better yourself. And, you know, when you're on set with 100 background actors or 50 or 12, everyone wants to be Tom Cruise. Everyone wants to make $1 million an episode. Everyone wants to be rich and famous. But the difference is, what are you doing when you're not complaining? What are you doing to make yourself more marketable or better in the trade? So I did a lot of research. Like, what do I have to do? But you know, John Bernthal went to Russia and he studied like theater in Russia when he was very young, and he came back to the U.S. And other people go to the school acting schools in New York, L.A. or wherever. And I don't have any of that under my belt. Like, no, you know, one play when I was in elementary school. But the difference is now I know where my weakness is. It's in just basic training. And there's some actors I'll tell you they don't even need lessons or training. Like, oh, that's overrated. And there's a part to that's true, because there is a natural talent and ability. So you don't have to have training, but it makes you a lot more marketable and to understand the little tips of the secrets of the trade, so to speak. So that's what I'm doing now, is like on a back end, getting my training in and getting more comfortable with auditions. And like, I have to learn a monologue. So I've been very successful, and I've never had to learn a monologue. But my last meeting with another agent, they said, "Okay, well, do you have a monologue prepared?" And I should have known, because I've heard that that's an industry thing. When you meet an agent, they're going to ask you, "Do you have a monologue?" And I was like, "Well, I'm doing self tapes, I'm doing auditions. I can't think of anything right now." So I was being honest. That could have cost me, and it might cost me landing an agent. But thankfully, I already have another one. But so what I'm going to do, John Bernthal did a great opening monologue for this show. It's 5 minutes long. And when you do a monologue audition, you got to cut things down to like 1 or 2 minutes. And you don't want to pick anything like, you can't handle the truth. You don't want anything too big and popular, or too vulgar. But I'm going to do that because it's related to my show. It's recent. And he plays a sergeant talking about use of force, if you watch the show. And I was an instructor in the academy, and I've spoke about use of force several times. So I think I can pretty much do his speech, and change it up if I have to and feel comfortable with it.
I think a lot of what something that you said resonates with me and many of the first responders and military guys and gals that I talk to. You said that drive, right? That dedication, that drive. And I always say my success does is not because I'm special. I'm not
No.
any better than anyone else. I just worked when others stopped working.
Exactly.
I researched when I didn't know, and I made mistakes. Do you feel the same way about your career? Like everything is just another benchmark of growth. But it takes you to wake up and go, I'm not good at this one particular thing. I need to move into some more training, some more research. What would you say in your acting career was that one part where you were just kind of like, this is not, I'm not very good at this part?
Well, there's a few things, but let me take it a little bit farther back. So, being a police officer for 24 years, I could say, and without bragging, as far as officers I know, I've had more advanced training. So that's non-mandated police training out on my own than anyone else I've ever met. And it's kind of frustrating when I see younger officers that don't have that drive. They're not looking for training. They're not. I'm a police lieutenant in patrol, and I can tell you, as a sergeant and a lieutenant, I hardly ever have officers that want to come to me for training. And I've been doing it for 24. Now, I can't say 24 years. So my point that I'm getting to is, I built my resume up professionally in the police, three different agencies I've been at, to the point where I basically did everything I wanted to do. And then as you get promoted, you start to lose the opportunities to work in specialized units. It's where they want you. But I stopped really professionally progressing. I was just trying to get promoted and not worried about training. I brushed off my resume, and it was very, very impressive. And then, boom, there's like an 8-year gap. And that just shows you I got comfortable in my job. I'm a sergeant now. I don't need any training. And you know what they say is you should always be adding training to your resume for just general purposes, right? So I kind of realized, you know what, let me look at my resume. Let me see what I need to add, what I want to add, where I'm going. And then that's still kind of separate than what I'm doing in acting. But to answer your question, as far as acting, the weaknesses, and I've posted this on social media. I think I have strengths and weaknesses. I think my weaknesses are really the training. It's like classical training, any type of training. Improv is it, I have no problem talking, like I'm talking to you now. Most police officers get over fear of public speaking. I took public speaking in college and then realized it wasn't an issue. We're good at like using ruses, aka lying to people for our safety. When a prisoner said, or a subject says, "Are you taking me to jail?" We're like, "Oh, we don't know. We got, we don't, not sure right now. Let's just hang out and figure it out." You're basically lying to the person, right? You're acting like you don't know what you're going to do, but you know you're waiting for backup. You know you're waiting for your sarge to get on scene. You know you're probably going to arrest them. That's a skill, right? And it's really improv. But improv and acting is a little bit different because if you and me are talking and you start talking about something I don't know anything about, it might feel weird for me and I might not know how to continue talking. So improv training, and it's not just comedy improv, but like, classical acting training, improv training, and it's just some basics. But there's, I definitely have strengths and I have weaknesses, but I think I'm marketable either way.
I think you said something that's really, really powerful, and it doesn't just apply to like your profession or, your skills of your job as a police officer or your skills of your job as a side hustle, or second career. And it's that kind of self-assessment of I'm not good at this. Why aren't cops seeking out training? I was an in-service supervisor, so I know exactly what you're talking about. I fought tooth and nail with a lot of cops just to do the basic training, like just to, get the basics down. It was like pulling teeth. But I think it also is important. I wanted to share kind of with our audience is that self-reflection, as a person, your mental health, your wellness, everything about it has to kind of balance and line up. And the first step is just taking a look at yourself, going, maybe you're not, maybe you're doing great, maybe you're a mess. But you have to say those words in the mirror, and then from there, it's, I think a little easier to put a foot forward. But so professionally in both categories, police work and acting, you just kind of look at it and say, I'm not where I want to be or where I should be in this particular moment in time. So this is what I need to do that. And so your acting career, did that, how long has that been going on total?
13 months straight, like nonstop. And I can tell you the unemployment rate for actors, not many people realize this, but it's like 84%. And then COVID hurt the acting, the entertainment industry. But some people say if you're going to be an actor, you have to be all out, move to LA, give up all your other jobs, and but then you're living out of your car, you're homeless, and then you're looking at going back to live with your parents. And a lot of successful actors right now have gone through that. And I look at the opposite. I say, hey, I'm comfortable. I'm not desperate when I do an audition. I'm not desperate. There's no despair or desperation. It's hey, this is fun. Cool. I hope I book this. This is awesome. I hope they like me. Maybe like a little self-conscious, and you got to be able to get past your fears, but you have to have that confidence. But that's where I'm at, really.
What would you say right now as a lieutenant, what would you say your strongest trait is in the police profession?
I would say my dedication, drive. Like I said, I'm comfortable in my career, and I think you can do two things. I mean, you can be a competent police officer, know your laws, do the right job, and you can have these side hobbies but it's really the drive to get things right, to do things the right way, and just really the experience and everything, trying to pa pass it on. But it's obviously being different, being a supervisor, sergeant, and lieutenant. And like I said, we were talking about training, but I'm still I was like the only one. There was not that many, but I went to like an advanced tactical medic class, trained by our SWAT team, who I used to be like a part of. And I look around, I was the only lieutenant, not only the only lieutenant, I look around, there's no sergeants. And there's only a few officers here and there. And I'm like, I can't believe this. Like, we're learning like really like life-saving care. But I'm also trying to tailor make, and you got to set yourself up for retirement too. I can tell you my favorite supervisors ever, my friends that are recently retired cops, they're happy because they retired. And they retired and they left a percentage on the table because they took another job that they wanted for whatever money. Maybe it's great money, maybe it's some money. But I have guys that are training at different agencies, private, public sector. And I see that. And then I've kind of learned now I'm at that point in my career where I'm giving advice to other officers. I still have 4 years. So what I tell people as you get closer, for us, my generation, it's a 20-year mark. For other officers, it's a 25-year mark. But as you get close to 20, 25, start looking at what you want to do. Take some time off. There's no rush because you're not going to retire tomorrow. But start thinking, having a plan, because the ones that aren't happy are the ones that have no plan. They're up for retirement. They don't know what they're going to do. And they just use the excuse of, my kids are still in school. I'm going to wait. My kids are going to college. And I'm not knocking that. But the ones that are happy are the ones that have a plan and they leave a percent behind, meaning they're not trying to stay to get, for my agency, it's 85% at, you know, 20, you know. You turn in your sick leave and all that. But guys are leaving at like 20, 21, 22. And I first thought I was going to stay, max out, you know, great money. But the guys that are leaving early are ones that are happy. But so I'm tailor making my resume. I'm looking at like tactical firearms training in the private sector, obviously the acting, anything else I can do, like police consultant. You know, for TV and film, police and tactical consultant. One of my friends is a retired Navy SEAL, Kevin Kent, and he's like big name in the TV and film industry as the military advisor. Like all these big name movies like Transformers or Jack Ryan, but like he's attached to all these. And I told him, I said, you have the job that I want. And he's done some acting too, but he'll tell you he'd rather be behind the camera and do some like work that way. Than like, you know, try to act like you're an actor. So I'm taking the work I can get, but the whole time I'm secretly hoping like that's, you know, these production companies hire me on a contracted basis and just be like, hey, we need a real cop. Like I've applied to be on that set of Rust, where Alec Baldwin's shooting, and they didn't even look my way. But imagine if they would have had a police officer that's competent nearby, that's a firearms instructor that knows like, hey, maybe we shouldn't play with these. But the industry doesn't work that way. They don't look at you as like you're anything unless they know who you are.
I think it's a pretty interesting when you talk about Rust, because I just saw a news clip when they had the person that was responsible for the gun management.
Yeah.
And what I saw was a very young lady that, to me, did not give the environment that she has prior law enforcement, military, hunting, three gun competition. I didn't see those little things, characteristics. And I'm like, wow. I mean, of all the people out there that are highly trained to manage, and I know from in-service training what it takes to make sure live rounds don't get mixed in to scenarios. Oh my God. You know what I mean? Because the last thing you want as a sergeant or a lieutenant is someone to get hurt on your, or die, you know, in your training. And so that's just mind-boggling. So I would think that career field would be wide open to retired cops, you know, retired law enforcement agents across the country, where they're just, or maybe it will be now. Maybe they're going to be like, all right, things have to change. We have to do this. I don't know, but
it's all about the money. Yeah.
Yeah.
They'll do what they can. I have a friend that's a producer and director, and honestly, it just comes down to money. They'd love to have you. If they can get you cheap, great. But nobody's looking to come find me, to use me, to pay me. And I've offered my services to many. So it's a small niche of the industry. And that's why I'm doing stuff for free. And basically, I'm selling my services as a consultant if you hire me as a cop in your movie show project. And sometimes that's people take advantage of it. Sometimes they don't even want to pay me my small rate. They'd rather pay someone else even less. And that's unfortunate. So maybe I'll have more success as an actor than as a consultant, but that's what it looks like.
Well, it's kind of interesting that you're going to travel both roads, just in whichever you feels right when it's time to, you know, I would imagine eventually down the road you'll probably have to pick one of those. You'll get a lot it, with your abilities, you'll get lots of opportunities and have to decide which one you're gonna
It's just like
follow into.
stunt work. So initially I was trying to book myself as a stuntman and actor, and you try to do the training, you try to put your name out there. But I realized with my age, I have a fear of heights, even though I'm rappel trained in SWAT school. You got to get over your fear of heights, and I don't like heights. So there's some stuff I can do, some I can't. But they pay stuntmen to stand to lay behind a fake sniper rifle and lay prone, and you get royalties for the rest of your life, and you get like minimum SAG rate of $1,000 for laying down and looking like a sniper. And I think I can do that since I was a real sniper. But it's that really is who you know. And if you don't know the right people, you're not going to be in the Rolodex. So I found a lot more success just doing regular acting roles than trying to get into these stunt roles. But and that's what I'm saying. My appetite was so big, I can't do all that. I want to learn additional languages, dialects. I want to be a stuntman. I want to be an actor. I want to be a consultant. I want to be, I want to drag race my Hellcat more often. And something's got to, especially when you have kids, something's got to give. And right now, it's definitely the drag racing and stunt work.
Yeah, you have to pick all the cake and icing that you want to have out of all this stuff. Hey, just a real quick question for you. I don't get an opportunity to interview many commanders. 2020 Minneapolis was extremely hard for all police officers. Did it become more challenging for you as a commander as the landscape became very political? And this is one reason I decided not to promote, because in our agency it became very political heavy, and leadership seemed to kind of be suppressed down, real leadership, inspiring leadership. And unfortunately, that was a reason I got out. But have you felt that same way out there on the East Coast? Is it really hard to manage people with opposing forces of all these different things going on?
Of course. I mean, as a lieutenant, they basically say I'm the rookie white shirts of all command staff, because we go up from lieutenants there. But yeah, I still consider myself like an officer's, I'm all for officers' rights first. But I also know our general orders and procedures. I know what you can and can't do. But I'm going to argue and fight for officers. If I have a maybe a problem, an issue with an employee, I'll encourage them to go to the union. I'll encourage them to go speak to somebody if they think I'm wrong. But that's generally speaking. But it has been tough, of course. 2015, I was a sergeant and I was watching CNN and Fox displaying everything. And because of we've always had negative media, but it started to get worse and worse and worse, and the narratives kept continuing. And it indirectly led to many police officers' lives being taken. And that is immeasurable. You can't say which ones, but you can kind of say that with some instances, because there are background information on people that were inflamed because of certain media outlets pushing a narrative. So yes, it got really, really bad. And actually, and I could talk about this because this case is officially closed. But as a command staff employee, I went to a designed, scheduled protest that wasn't even about my agency. It was about someone else, like a special police officer or something. And I was instructed to make contact with the people organizing the event, talk to them, let them know we're there to assist them, anything they need. And it's kind of odd, because you're dealing with people that are outright anti-police. And the first thing you're saying is, we're here for you. Anything you need, let us know. Obviously, they have a right to assemble, freedom of speech. And I was very polite, introducing myself, and I was immediately mobbed, if you want to use that term, by several protesters with signs, getting in my face, bumping me with their signs, demanding to know my name, which I had just told them. Many police officers know the feeling that I'm explaining. So you introduce yourself and you tell them why you're there, and people immediately get mad and say they want to know your name. Well, I just told you my name, and it's also on my name tag. But yeah, I had a person file a false complaint against me, and it was just recently, finally, I guess, adjudicated, or whatever you call it, where it was unfounded, which is a lot better than just not sustained, and obviously sustained. But unfounded means you either lied or yes, it happened, but it didn't happen, happen the way you're explaining it. But being targeted by protesters unfairly is definitely unsettling. And different states passing this legislation, and people want police reform, but they don't understand. Like, so when now when every complaint is going to be part of your permanent history jacket that anyone can see, they'll see a false complaint against me. And as a police officer, an employee with rights, you would think that if it's proven false, you could just hit delete. But no, like someone else could now come along and say, oh yeah, he did also do something like that. And that's kind of unfair. But all these states are having different problems in legislation. I personally see that it'll be like a cyclical trajectory with this as far as it's hard to hire officers. You want to defund police, but now you want to pay police. So these agencies and cities are seeing that what works, what doesn't work. But that, some states are putting legislation in to protect officers from onlookers, while other states are kind of doing the opposite. So it's definitely a challenging time. I've never seen anything like it in my life, in my career. And officers not only have to worry about their safety, now they got to worry about their property being seized and being placed in jail for either accidents or honest mistakes. We talk about the what is it, the Supreme Court ruling. It was Graham versus Connor, basically the reasonableness, use of force, and you can't use hindsight 2020. You got to be able to use the same factors. An officer with a similar background, training, history, same size, what they know to that, the facts that that officer knows at the time, and all that gets thrown out the window when you have like a mayor of Atlanta saying, "Well, I just don't think it looks right. We should fire him." And so you have politicians making decisions on what use of force is and not acceptable. So that's dangerous territory. In a specific case in Atlanta, I think those cops got their job back. But they're changing these standards, and some standards are a big gray area where they're not even clearly defined. So it's definitely dangerous at times. But as a commander, it's, worried about myself, worried about my officers. I tell them, and I've trained riot control, I've trained in the academy. And I've done articles before of like, shouldn't our training change? Because we're trained as officers to keep 6 feet distance from the other person, watch their hands, watch for signs of danger and stuff like that. But then we're thrown in the middle of a riot situation and we tell them to hold the line while they're getting rocks thrown at them and being pelted. And officers get scared just like anybody else. They're human beings. And we're preaching, don't take any independent action. Wait for the supervisor who has to have their head on a swivel anyways. To take, to tell you what action to take. So it's really scary and dangerous. And I don't know what the answer is, but we need to take steps to protect our officers physically and through proper legislation.
Yeah, I think that's very well said, and I'm glad you kind of touched on that because it's kind of it's gotten lost in all of this shuffle over the last couple of years, and even as far back as Ferguson in 2014, I think this is when this
Oh,
stuff
yeah.
had really started. Every cop across the country has just felt immense pressure that sometimes, it results in tragic stuff for some of these cops, one way or the other, whether it was, at their own hand or the hand of being scared to make a decision, and scared
Oh,
to
yeah.
do something that you and I 20 years ago wouldn't even hesitated.
It's causing officers their lives. Officers are being killed because of failure to act, and that's can't be measured. The media will never know that an officer was killed today because he was worried about drawing his gun. But we know from crime scene investigations, eyewitness testimony, where officers are grabbing their OC spray. I've seen it. Doing use of force reviews. I had an officer attacked physically by somebody punching him, pushing him, and pulling out a knife and OC spray. The officer pulls out his baton and just holds it by his side. If someone pulls out a knife and they just punched you and they're 2 feet away, that's deadly force. Everybody understands that. Now you can say, well, the guy had a lot of restraint not to shoot him. But is it restraint or is he really worried about being sued, for shooting him or, So the failure to act is causing officers to lose their lives. But many and the public believe that's we knew what we were going, we knew what we were doing when we signed up for this job. So you hear that from people that don't truly understand.
Yeah, that's really good points, and thank you for sharing that. Switching gears just a little bit, back to acting a little bit. What's been your favorite role? I know you don't want to tarnish your reputation, but what was the role that you like? You just like blown away. This was awesome. Can't wait to do something like it again.
Well, my biggest role, like professionally, is obviously just the one I just did, being a part of like the HBO family and We Own the City, and working for award winning. You know, I was cast on my first ever live audition from an Emmy award winning casting director. I was handpicked by a producer that created co-creator of The Wire. So that's like my most proud, biggest moment. But I don't have that many lines. As far as like thing that I really like, I've got a lot of lines. I've proven to myself that I can memorize my lines, script that I can deliver, project that I really like and proud of is Talons of the Phoenix, which just finished filming. So I play a World War II. It's a period piece, a World War II U.S. Army general. And I had to memorize 80 lines of dialogue, I believe. And it was all shot in one day. It's 12 hours. And it was just three scenes. But that I was able to prove to myself that I can memorize lines, that I can deliver. And I had scenes with five other established, competent actors that all had different levels of experience, but training. And I saw myself thinking, wow, I guess I can do this if I'm able to hang with these guys. So as far as most proud, we just finished, and it's an independent film, but also networking has been great because I've been able to help get people on films and shows that I've been a part of. And because of networking, I was able to get this actor named Costas Mandalore to help bring him on board for this movie. And he was in the Saw franchise. Like he was a detective in the Saw horror film, like 3, 4, 5, 6, I think. But just making friends with some actors here, and they know this person, you know, I get them a job, they try to get me a job. So networking is good. It's important. And it's not necessarily a bad thing. A lot of actors or people think you have to know somebody, but it doesn't. People say that with a negative connotation. It's actually a good thing to be able to know people and vouch for people. And I'd say most cases, or at least some cases. So that's the thing I've been most proud of, because I can tell you, if you don't have your lines, if you're nervous, you're just starting out, it could be hard for you to just memorize four sentences. And then you're sweating, you're nervous, people are watching you. And it's not about speaking in public. It's about trying to remember your lines and be believable. But you have to be familiar with the material to feel comfortable. And then that's really when the fun begins.
You mentioned The Walking Dead earlier. How fun was that? Because I'm a big Walking Dead fan. Like, I won't watch this last season because I want to watch the whole thing in its entirety when it's all done.
Oh, yeah.
So, but how was that, working on that?
It was great. I mean, I didn't know how many days I would get the film. I figured a few days, but that's where I met Kevin Kent. We went through CRM soldier boot camp for 80 hours. And I was on our SWAT team, and he's training us like Navy SEALs. Well, not really like Navy SEALs, but a lot of like the movements, commands. And I knew about 90% of what he was teaching. I was like, yeah, I'm on board. So that was fun. And it was a great experience. Fortunately, my face is covered by a black mask, and you can't see me in most of the shots that I was in, but I was in right next to some main characters in many episodes. But it's cool to be attached to the series that, like, you know, I was a fan of. I watched like everyone else. So you go from being a fan to being, you know, involved as an actor or however. And I was a reoccurring role, and I kept being bumped up. You know, I was like a director's choice for like this specific role. You know, I was being called back several times. So I was starting to see like, hey, they're calling me quite often. So then it was all about just making myself available. So I did a grind not many people understand. You talk about how do you have time. I would work midnight shift on patrol and change out, switch cars, and drive 2.5 hours to just take a COVID test to stay eligible to film 2 days later. And so that's 5 hours of driving, 3 days a week minimum, just to take COVID tests and then actually film when they needed me and when I can. And I'm not a young chicken, but, I'm awake on set and I'm excited and I'm ready to go. And I look over and I see like 21-year-old kids sleeping, waiting to get on camera. And they went to sleep last night. I'm like, well, the driving people are different. But yeah, it's a great franchise and series. But and I'm a big fan. The funny thing is people ask questions. They're like, are you a fan? Do you watch the show? And I'm like, yeah. And I kind of trailed off. And the funny thing is to talk to how many actors that have stopped watching which show at what point. Because it'd be hard pressed to find any actor that has seen every show from every all the three series from beginning to end. So I'm like everyone else, like, oh, I was a big fan, and then they just kept going. But shows have like an endpoint, like Breaking Bad. I think it's a lot better. But they keep that money train moving and going forward, and a huge, huge thing. I have fans like in foreign countries and everything, and I just have minor role. But that was my launching pad. It was background, but it was a grind. And that helped me land the next job. And it's land, I just keep parlaying into bigger and better things.
Yeah, you mentioned early on, we talked about the dedication to both professions, really, but mainly we're kind of focusing on that outlet or that second career, that afterlife of police work. Then you just mentioned sacrifice. Nobody wants to drive 2.5 hours one way to take a test to be ready to work, right? And so, but that's what it takes. You have to sacrifice your time, your sleep, your time with your family. So I think that's what, if you want to be successful in the afterlife of police work, or in police work too, is you just got to have, you sacrifice. But,
Yeah, I'll give you another example. Say in police work, a lot of people say, I want to be a canine officer. I want to be a canine handler. And they think someone's just going to hand that to them. When I wanted to join the SWAT team, I told myself I have to be in the best shape of my life. I have to run the fastest mile. I have to run faster than the other 15 applicants. So, I mean, why should we hire you? Why should we take you to this elite unit, specialized unit? What are you going to do? What are you going to show? What are you bringing to us? But an example of a canine unit is how many back in the day officers used to come in on their time off, days off, or adjust, or whatever they have to do to volunteer to jump into a bite suit to show the canine team that they want to be part of the team. And nowadays, you don't hear that. Someone just puts in a resume and says, yeah, it's a more entitled. And it's not about you being young. It's just about a newer generation of employees that feel like they're entitled to everything. But you don't, yeah, you got to put the work in. And if you do, you'll be rewarded. Definitely. So whatever you want to do, try to be the best of. And really, just look at it like you're competing against yourself, no, nobody else. Just try the hardest you can do for yourself.
yeah, I think one of the things I used to tell folks when I was a SWAT team leader, and we were, have these, hey, we do an announcement, we're going to do some testing in the fall, and you start getting the, all the people that are interested. But as time goes on, you start to see who's really interested. And right
Yeah.
away, I was able to kind of pick out, like, this guy just wants the shirt. He's probably not going to make it. You know what I mean? Just based on the way they were, not because of their performance on individual skills, but their overall attitude and how bad they wanted it. I saw some people that I would have guessed if you said, hey, so and so is going to test for SWAT, I'd be like, ugh, I don't know, man. But then I saw them go to work and actually put the work in. I was like, yeah, I'll have that as a teammate any day. They're a
Yeah.
hardworking person. So I think that dedication and that drive and putting that work in to get that job is super, super important.
Yeah.
So you've got 13 months worth of work. Do you have anything on the horizon that's big as well?
Well, I tell people like as far as my professional acting goals, I'm achieving them. I've got check marks and I'm heading in the right direction. So like I said, I'm on HBO. We Own This City. I'm on two episodes, episode 1 and 5, and I'm using that really, and I'm parlaying into obtaining new representation, and I'm getting audition invites. And there's a difference between me trying to find a role in like low budget roles, local roles, and then being allowed to audition for good bigger roles. And then a step up from that is people trying to find or finding you to ask you, hey, would you put in for this? And most people still have to audition. Even good actors have to audition. But in the last 2 weeks, I've had I think 5 audition invites. which is the best I've done in the past 13 months. And they're all for major TV shows or film. And of course, the percentages the way they are, I'd be lucky to book one of them. But that's what I'm doing now. So I'm very close to, and you got to be patient seeing the next. And so my goal was where I was at right now is to get audition invites after my first major speaking role on a union SAG film or show. And that's where I'm at. So the next thing would be booking the second. You know what I mean? So now you can say, oh, I've done a couple. And because they called me back, I got this the second one. So, you have to have goals and you have to have a route to get to those. You can't just hope that people hand things to you. But as far as, coming out, I'm constantly looking at IMDb because a lot of times they don't tell us when things are, for like some of these independent films and shows, I kind of know where we're at in the process. Like I still need to film a couple days on this TV show called a thriller TV show called The Clowns that they're going to pitch to streaming services, like a horror thriller show. The Talons of the Phoenix just finished principal photography. So now I have to do the editing and then distribution. But I have like another HBO, White House Plumbers, some other, shows and movies I'm waiting to hear. When are they going to get released? When are they going to get announced? And a lot of times the actors just don't know. But that's, and some people are nervous because they need the work. They're desperate. They're upset. They're auditioning for everything. And I, between the jobs is to me is actually a fun time too, because it's exciting to not know what's next. I know what I want to do, but who knows, who knows which director is going to call me first. And then if they call me, I'm going to, you're going to own me for those days of the year of the calendar, So I'm excited. And I just want to now hurry up and catch up with like training and skills. Because half of being an actor is self-promotion or getting a PR team. So you got to promote, but what are you promoting? You better be promoting some type of ability. So there are other people that are very, very good actors and they do zero promotion. And it costs them jobs. They don't realize it, but it costs them jobs. So you got to be well-rounded.
Yeah, you got to get in front of the right eyeballs. Whether you're in sales, you own a coffee business, or you're in acting, yeah. you gotta put yourself in the right spots. And no one's gonna do that for you, right? I mean,
yeah.
Tom Hanks didn't get to his spot without the right people plugging him in, or whoever, whatever big actor that that does that kind of stuff is on the ground. Someone had to plug them in and get in front of people to say, hey, this is the right person for this role or whatever the case is. And yeah. Oftentimes in the beginning, it's you, just like when you own a business, it's you,
Definitely. That's what you do when you don't have an agent. And a lot of people book more jobs without their agent than with their agent. But agents are very important because they have the relationships with the casting directors for the bigger roles. So you can do little side gigs, short films, student films, plays, non-union work or whatever here or there. But when you're talking about the bigger money, the bigger projects where everyone wants to be, you really need good agency representation that has those relationships. And if they don't, you're sitting by a phone that's never going to ring, honestly. But I had a PR guy, PR company, public relations call me, a publicist, out of the blue, and I told him everything I've done for myself. And he was interested. But this agency was saying basically they want to see if I can start booking more and more roles from here, and if I can get like a series regular, which is very important. It's a big deal, before maybe we work together. But that's not going to slow down the PR that I'm already doing.
Yeah, for sure. Kind of off the subject just slightly. When you proposed this to your family, like, hey, I want to do some acting. How did that go? I'm just curious.
Well, like I said, I mean, it's depends on what day and the mood, my wife's in, but she showed me the role, the listing for Walking Dead World Beyond. She showed it to me. We put in and I was excited. I showed her, hey, they called me back. She's like, wow, that's great. But people don't understand. Like when you have two children and she's working from home, it's very stressful to work with toddlers screaming and climbing on you. And you're trying to do maybe a Zoom interview like this. So something has to give, and it's tough. So I'm working in DC and Georgetown all day, and she'll just ask, like, so what time are you coming home? Like, and I have to say, I have no idea. And that's, people have to understand the industry. There is no strict checkout time. I mean, police work is more predictable than entertainment industry. So it's tough, but they're understanding. But she's the one that really got me into it. We're trying to balance, like, what we want versus what we can do versus what's feasible, what's reasonable, right? So I mean, all this is new, but I can tell you what I have been doing is I've been working a lot less police overtime, which last year caused me a dip in pay, but it helped with my mindset, mental health, and in doing something I really like, and that's, not as dangerous. And that's where I'm at now. So, and I'm challenging myself to work even less. I've kept track of my overtime for the past 6, 7, 8 years, and I'm going to make sure that I keep it lower and lower, because I can't, work all these hours of overtime in the police department and then all these acting hours on the side, and then still be a good husband and a father. Something's got to give. So I'm trying to kick that habit of a cop that just works too much, and he knows he's working too much, but he can't stop. And I can preach to my young officers, live within your means, don't rely on that overtime. And then I end up doing it myself. So thankfully, financially, I'm doing fine now. But you don't want to get in those troubles. So I'm forcing myself to work less police overtime to make it easier, to make all these other decisions.
Yeah, it's interesting. When I told my wife 4 years ago, "Hey, I'm gonna do some coffee stuff," and she's like, "What?" But then, fast forward to where we're at now, she's my biggest supporter. And hey, what do you, have you? You need to fix this on the website. You need to do this, and finding these little things. And so we make a great team. And it sounds like you guys did the same. And
Well, she
probably,
does. She
yeah.
still does. I mean, she encourages me. I mean, just the other day, she's like, "Oh, wouldn't it be cool to move to LA and have a house out there?" And I was like, "LA? We both kind of hate the politics of certain states, excuse me, and jurisdictions." But I kind of told her, like, "Well, slow down. Like, I'm not getting million-dollar roles, just yet." But she likes certain aspects. I was talking about, hey, if I can get invited to some red carpet events, there's a possibility that I could be going to, like, events in LA for premieres, showings and screenings and stuff like that. And I kind of told her, like, thinking that she wouldn't even be interested, and she surprised me, and she was like, "Yeah, that'd be awesome. I want to go. Great." And I was like, "Wow." Like, just depending on the day and the stress that she's dealing with, she's either going to be excited about what's going on with me, or could care less. You know what I mean? So
I think I experienced the same things. It's
yeah.
it's and honestly, I always say this, that the spouses of first responders, they're unspoken heroes. You don't hear much about them and what they do, and they sacrifice behind the scenes, but
Yeah.
we're grateful for the support at home. One last question want to pose to you is and I ask usually all my guests. You're walking out the door on day of retirement, and a young rookie's walking into supply. You just turned your gear in, and they're going to get gear. What do you tell them, he or she?
I'll smile and probably throw them a thumbs up and say, "Good luck." But if we're having an in-depth conversation, trust me, I've dealt with this more and more over the years, especially since the riots. I mean, you'd say 2014, 15 on. It's tough. I want them to know what they're getting into. I want them to be smart. I want them to worry about their job and their family, almost as much as they're worried about their safety. But it's very tough. I mean, one of the first few things the chief of police told us, or told me when I met him, was that he would like these officers, us, everyone, to speak better of the occupation in order to recruit our eventual replacements, but also to recruit our backup, our officers, that we need officers now, today, tomorrow, next year. I'll be here for another 4 years. I'm going to need people to join the force. So it's like that internal issue, where it may not even be anything necessarily bad about my specific agency. It's just policing in general. And kind of my response to that is, not to my chief, but generally speaking, is like, I mean, I can recruit, but what are the politicians putting in place to protect us? I mean, and in who's voting for who, for what reasons? So help me help you. You know what I mean? If the community wants help and agency wants help, politicians want help, well, you gotta allow us to recruit. I mean, pay us more, give us better training. Now the big thing is like mental health awareness and getting officers, psychological services and help. And our agency has that available. But it's like two psychologists for a huge agency. And like I guess the U.S. Capitol Police had nothing when they got in their riots, and they had a couple officers commit suicide and medically retire. And they were reaching out to different agencies in the area. And so all these politicians are on TV talking about officers' mental health is important. We need to get these guys help. But like, look, right now, how much help do we have? And you're telling me there's not enough psychologists out there in the private sector to just be signed by a government agency as an on-staff psychologist for mental health? So mental health in general has just declined in this country since deinstitutionalization, in my opinion. But yeah, I can encourage a guy, give him good words, tell him what he needs to, I can't tell him everything he needs to know. Can't possibly cover everything, but we can recruit, we can train, but we need the support. Without the support, they'll sign up and they'll come out a revolving door. Or if we lower our standards, we're going to let the wrong people in. And if people don't understand, that's a cycle. When DC stopped doing their polygraphs and in-depth background investigations, they just hired a bunch of, or at least several people that were former gang members, active drug users. And they're like, oh, well, man, this is horrible. Well, it's because you didn't do your due diligence and do your background checks and stuff. So the answer isn't lowering the standards to get more people. And that's, some people don't want to hear those answers, and they're tough answers and questions to address. But I can tell you what's my opinion, not necessarily the views of anyone else or any other agency, my employer. But my opinion is you keep standards high. You have to, including, in an academy. Back in the day, if a recruit started shaking and crying and said they want to quit, you let them quit. Nowadays, you can't let people quit. Oh no, we need you. You can't quit. And a race, demographic, all that plays a part, and that's just unheard of. So my experiences is, my first academy 24 years ago, the Albuquerque Police Department, we lost every female, and they had a 50% attrition rate. So I think they started with like 50, and they graduated like 24. Many injuries, many people resigned, and they changed their ways so they weren't breaking as many students. But today that's unheard of. You would not allow that many people to resign. And the more nowadays it's more collegiate type atmosphere. That's a long-winded answer to your question. I apologize,
No,
but
I think it's great. It's really good insight, especially from obviously you've got a lot of years on and you're, in a management position. And I really like, the whole thing about what you're talking about with mental health and where we're at. I like too is
yeah.
you're the first guest to say, tell them good luck. Give them an honest, I like what your chief said, talk positive about the police department. I myself got
Yeah.
down in a slump when I was leaving and didn't talk highly of the profession, and I think
Yeah.
that has to change. And I also think we have to be honest too. We have to be honest with ourselves as police agencies and not hire people and keep them that shouldn't be there, and we shouldn't be hiding some of the dangerous or tough parts of this job. Everyone that gets hired should know exactly what they're getting into, and
Right.
be and prepared for it and be able to deal with it. But you're right, there's also some support outside of that individual new recruit that has to change, and that's on the politicians.
You know what you say prepared for, and nobody's talking about this, and I think I'm the only one that's ever brought this up. People talk about police reform. What can we do? Why are we shooting so many people? All these things. No one ever talks about we need advancements in technology. Our tasers have been around for 2 decades now, and now we have a problem with officers with over-reliance on tasers. So they're having misfires. They're not doing the full NMI, neuromuscular contraction or whatever. But I mean, and it sounds silly, but we need to start thinking about, like, with Elon Musk, I mean, you're telling me there's no scientists out there that can't figure out something that can fit on a bat belt that Batman carries on his duty belt, which shoots out like a web. And I know these are contraptions of like lariat or whatever you call it, where it wraps around your, like a bolo lariat, it wraps around your feet. But really, like advancements in technology. So we're not just going either from taser to hands-on or taser to gun. And officers are not using their batons anymore. They are not using their OC spray. And I come from a generation where I used everything on my belt that I had to, and it was totally justified. But I would like to see advancements in technology, and nobody's talking about that at all. Everyone's just like, oh, we need to do better training. Like, we need better equipment. We need something on our belt that we can shoot at somebody, spray at somebody. Like slowly deactivate a car. In chases, instead of like, we're not trained to even stop chases, we're trained to follow cars. And then if they wreck, we get sued and lose our job and go to jail. But yeah, advancements in technology. I mean, all we have is batons. I mean, you'd rather see me, on NFL game day on the field using a steel baton or whatever it is, on somebody, than using some other device where I can just like, trap them, slow them down. I mean, honestly, I don't care if it's like tranquilizers, not equating people to animals, but some type of advancements in technology where we can safely apprehend people, where we can reduce the injury rate, reduce the death rate, reduce the shooting incidents, that will work. And that's the thing, technology. We don't know what we don't know yet, right? So I think in 20, 30 years, you're going to see all these cool things. But when we need them is right now, when everybody's mad at us, or a lot of people are mad. But it's just nobody's talking about that. But that's the one thing I'm thinking about. Like, okay, when you're seriously thinking about answers, how do we reduce this and that? Well, we need better tools on our belt, probably. Advancements. That's just my opinion.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I would add in there probably a lot more training with hands-on. I think that's dissipated in most agencies across the country. You're starting to see jiu-jitsu creep up there, which I think is a very applicable art, but it takes practice. It takes dedication to do that. There's lots of things in there, and technology sure as heck. I mean, just let's advance the taser so that it doesn't have a 40 or 50%. Whatever it is, effectiveness. And we've all seen tasers fail, and we've seen them work too, and so it's kind of a toss up, but we became too reliant on them doing the
No,
job.
it's
And, if you were going to get in a car right now and I told you had a 40 to 50% chance of living, would you drive? Why would you trust a taser? Why can't we, fix some of this stuff? But,
Yeah, I've only really used my taser one time or twice in my entire career, in 24 years. And I've had maybe 16 years or give or take, but I've only used it twice, which means I was either hands-on or I was using OC spray or I was using my baton, or hands-on. And I've never shot anybody. I've been at shootings. It's a different generation. Officers don't use their baton. They don't use their OC spray. You got to get back to the basics if we're going to give it to them. Otherwise, take it off their belt. Don't even give it to them. And let's do the studies of why they don't need it. But if we're handing it to them, just people are officers are afraid, or they don't have the mentality. They don't. And I've seen officers become instructors and teach batoning, ASPBATON certified, and they've never used it. And I'm not saying you got to shoot someone to be able to teach people how to shoot, but if you've never been in a real fight where you're using a baton, how are you going to teach that to a student, or the OC spray, because they didn't like how it felt, getting sprayed in their academy, that they're afraid to spray somebody else. I've been contaminated from my own spray, and you know what? It worked because it got the person off of me. I was entangled and I couldn't get off of them. And I had another officer come around, and he asked, "Do you want me to shoot him?" And I said, "No." And I was getting my OC spray out. I sprayed him, and he was right in my face. He disengaged, is what you want if somebody's wrapping you up. I'll worry about the apprehension after I'm free. So he disengaged. This kid, I call him kid, he ran away, but then he wasn't so smart that he ran, basically came back. I guess, with this mother to complain. And that's when I was able to safely arrest him. But I can tell you, like, if you need it, go ahead and spray someone. You know you can breathe after you get sprayed accidentally. It's not going to be fun, but it could save your life. But officers, it's taser or hands-on or shooting somebody, in my opinion. But everything else is too graphic. They're too scared. And what's the public going to see if somebody's recording us using our baton on somebody more than if you hit someone more than two times?
Yeah, we saw that. It was right? called 1992, in California. But some great points. Lastly, where can our listeners find out more about you? Where would you draw?
I tell people, like, for the longest time, I was private on all my social media as a cop, and now I've learned to clean up, post or keep things clean and try to be neutral. But I'm open now on Instagram, Victor Dobro Official with underscores. I have a website that I made myself, victordobro.com. And I tell people to go to my IMDb. It's like an actor's online resume. So it's showing everything that I've done, even as a consultant, everything, what projects that I've attached myself to that people have invited me to. And I'm constantly checking the status of different projects so they can see real time, just like I can, of what's popping up. And there's a pro platform, paid, and there's free. But if you just Google my name, it should lead you to probably everything with the IMDb credits, or maybe the DC Generals football team that I helped create in public safety, raising money for charity over the years. But yeah, any of those websites. I have an actor's page on Facebook. But I'm very engaging with fans. I respond to really all the messages. I'm not there yet where I'm too highbrow, or whatever you call it, where I'm not responding to people. I mean, if somebody sends me a message, email, and they compliment me, and I say, thank you very much. You know what I mean? And if they ask questions, I give them advice. The whole thing about lifting people up. And if you're interested in the industry, hit me up. And I tell you, if you're in law enforcement or not, and this has been my route, but I give you, I'd like to secure my roles in projects. And once that's secure, I try to bring everyone else I can on board, but this is also a competitive business. And I've seen people that aren't as gracious, I guess, because they feel like they're competing. And we are. I'm friends with other cops that are actors, and we're all competing for the same roles. But, I try to, teach one, lift one up. And I find more personal, gratification by helping others, getting in projects, getting into acting. I'm having a great time, but it's cool to make friends, to network, and to be able to help others. So that's been fun.
I think there's a lot to glean from helping others and lifting others up, when the payback is, I'm a big believer of karma. You're out there doing good. Yeah, you are competitive and you are going for jobs, but at the same time, you can help others. And that's pretty cool. We will have all of that listed in the show notes where you can find Victor and kind of take a look at it or reach out to him. Victor, I want to thank you for being on the show today. It was really insightful and it was a nice change up. We talked a little bit about wellness, but we also talked about, heavily on balance, dedication, sacrifice. I like what you said, because I've been preaching this. Don't be married to a retirement date or a lump sum number or amount of overtime, because there is happiness outside of law enforcement. If you got a passion, whether it's whatever, woodworking, coaching kids football, whatever, go for it and don't let anything stop you. Victor, any parting words for us?
No, just thanks for having me on, and good luck with your podcast. I think what you're doing is great. And honestly, like, this is one of the major reasons why I got into it is the mental health and wellness. And I'm not ashamed to say it, being stressed out, worried about your job, personal safety, wanting to find something else. I'm not quitting my day job tomorrow, but I'm trying to do what I can to transition. And I'm talking to normal human beings. Cops are dealing with, they see the bad, the good and bad, but it's important. Like I said, it would do whatever you want to do. Click baseball cards, click stamps, like you said, woodworking. So I totally agree. Find something you love. And if you can make money, a little bit of money doing it, great.
Yeah, even if it's just enough money to pay for your hobby, that's perfect, you know. And I think it's we've seen other first responders very successful in, you know, their whatever their passions are and their following. So again, thank you, Victor. We appreciate it. That'll conclude this episode of Talking Filthy Police Podcast, sponsored by Filthy Pirate Coffee. Take care. Put your mask on first so that you can breathe before you take care of everyone else, just like on the airplane.
Thank you.